Transitioning to a decarbonised economy sounds like just one change. In fact, this shift requires several transitions across sectors, geographies, and timelines. In Talking Transitions, a new podcast brought to you by the EY organisation and Foresight Climate and Energy, we look at how the transition is affecting three key areas: energy, financial services, and government. The Talking Transitions podcast is out now. Download today from wherever you get your podcasts or visit talkingtransitions.com to find out more.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I went through a process of realizing that this world as it exists now, it's done. It does not have a future, or the future it has is unthinkably awful.
Hi, I'm Sarah Wilson, and this is Wild, a podcast about living a more beautiful and fired up life. Here we will continue my 10-year nomadic journey, living out of one bag, in search of more connection, more awakeness, less consuming, less loneliness, and less bloody scrolling. I'll be inviting you to join me in finding better ways to radically love and save our one wild and precious life on this planet. In this episode of Wild, I speak with Margaret Klein Salomon.
I'm Margaret Klein Salomon. I'm a clinical psychologist and climate activist.
In 2014, aged just 29, Margaret co-created the Climate Mobilization, an organization based out of New York, which has pushed more than 1,000 cities around the world to declare a climate emergency. She's written two books about the climate emergency. She has a PhD in clinical psychology. She's a member of the Climate Emergency Fund's advisory board, and she's become the voice in showing how facing our fear and grief around the climate mess will best mobilise us into action. Now, I have interviewed scores of scientists, IPCC advisors, and experts about the climate crisis in the past 3 years, but Margaret delivers the stark reality like no one I've met. It's definitely wild, and I should warn you, though, it will also hurt like hell. When she first told me this truth, which we're about to deep dive into, I felt like physically sick.
This world as it exists now, it's done.
I invited Margaret to discuss this whole thing again here from her home office in New York, where she's currently juggling a COVID puppy.
And he's adorable and I love him so much, but he's like obsessed with me. And so he keeps coming in here. So I'm telling my husband, like, no, I can't. You have to keep him away. Yes, this is important. It is important.
As I say, her wild truth is not easily digested, but also paradoxically, it's brought me a very odd flavour of comfort and sense of arrival in my life. I think you'll see what I mean. So, Margaret, this is our third time chatting, and welcome to my podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure. It's an interesting one because in this podcast I explore wild ideas that get us activated and get us connected back into what really matters. And as you know, one of my big frames of reference is the climate crisis. And I really wanted to bring you in because we chatted some time back and we happened to meet a second time in Bondi shortly after the 2020 bushfires here in Australia. And it was a very pivotal moment. And we went and had a coffee in this chaotic sort of space. There was chaos everywhere. And you planted this idea with me, this thought, this quote, which has haunted me ever since. And I'll just warn everybody here listening, it's heavy. It's super, super heavy. What you said to me was that you know that you are going to die of climate change. And I want to explore this with you because it's heavy. And at first, I think the blood drained from my face because I hadn't heard anyone say it as upfront as that. But then afterwards, I felt this incredible sort of elevation of freedom, which is a really odd thing to say, but I think that's what we're going to explore. It's a wild idea. So, Margaret, can we kick off with you perhaps explaining why you know this to be true? Because you only work in hard facts.
Yeah, so I don't know it to be true. In fact, I spend every day trying to do everything I can to make it untrue. But with short of a totally transformational global mobilization that for zero emissions and to reverse the sixth mass extinction of species as quickly as humanly possible, short of that, yeah, this is a sinking ship. I mean, we're facing the collapse of civilization. Lester Brown, the former Undersecretary of Agriculture in the U.S., makes it very clear is that while there's so many things happening with the climate emergency, epidemics and hurricanes and fires, all of these horrible things, the most devastating thing to watch is the food supply.
Yes.
And drought and invasive species and soil degradation, but causing food shortages, which cause collapse. They cause destabilization and collapse. I mean, hungry people don't just sit quietly. They overthrow their governments. They emigrate to other countries. And it's so what we're facing, it's not a, quote, environmental
yes
problem.
Yes.
We are looking at the collapse of everything, of our civilization, all of our systems. And so that, I mean, that is the threat. That is the immediate threat.
That's right. I remember you clarified it when we spoke and you said, well, it's not that I'm going to die of inundation. It's not that I'm going to necessarily die of pollution. It's going to be mass civil unrest. And I loved that quote. I loved hated it, that, you know, hungry people don't just lie down and die, they fight. And I think you're right. It's the first time I'd actually realised that is the most terrifying, alarming aspect of this. I want to sort of come back to some of those facts in a moment, but there's also a freeing aspect to it, isn't there? And I know that there was a little bit of a sort of awakening for you, and I've certainly gone through that. I feel an incredible amount of freedom and also that comes from meaning in my life now as a result of facing the climate truth. Tell me about that for you, especially from a clinical psychologist's point of view. Why does that happen to those of us who do face the truth front on?
It is a psychological truism that the truth feels good inherently, and that distorting the truth and using psychological defenses to protect ourselves is inherently depleting.
Yeah.
And so that's one thing. It's just, I mean, it's always better to look at a situation in yourself, in your family, in politics, in the world system. It's always better to look at it for what it is rather than to try and shield yourself in different ways.
Because it's exhausting, isn't it? It's exhausting to deny the truth. It psychologically, it takes everything out of us to do that, to live in denial, and it causes sickness, for instance.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the other thing is really about grief. And I think kind of the freeing or, I don't know, the transformative power of grief, because I went through a process of realizing that this world as it exists now, it's done. It does not have a future, or the future it has is unthinkably awful. And looking at my future as not the, you know, when I was a kid, my mom and my teachers, they told me that I could be whoever I wanted to be, anything I wanted to be. And the future was bright, and technological progress and social progress, you know, and just realizing that that is not true, that we are living in a period of, accelerating collapse. And yeah, the life I thought I had, which was going to be a clinical psychologist and have a family and, you know, just have a nice career, a nice life, it wasn't going to happen. It's not possible to have a nice life like that in a collapsing world. And so realizing that, grieving the future that I thought I had, realizing that all my beautiful plans and aspirations were not going to happen was actually tremendously freeing, because it means I have this moment. I have this opportunity to fight for humanity and the living world, to try to cancel the apocalypse, right? That is what I have. I don't have the future. I don't have a bright future or a, you know, that, and so it certainly has allowed me to, let's say, not hold back.
And just so everybody here knows, I mean, you're in your early 30s, is that right?
Mid-30s.
Give or take. But, you know, these are all very real goals and aspirations. And I remember when I was in my early to mid-30s, you know, it was a lot about run-up. So a lot of my energy went into planning what was going to come next, preparing my career, preparing my psychology for a love life that I was going to have. And I know that would be the space you and many people listening are in, even regardless of the age. We all have plans. That energy you transformed into energy that you could put into doing something right now, like in an immediate framework. Maybe talk us through the process of grief and what happens if you don't process it, because we are a culture that runs away from any discomfort, and grief is deeply uncomfortable, and we don't know how to talk about it, live through it, pass through it, and then come out into the present and have an awesome life.
Grief is an amazing psychological process that's universal among humans, and it is the process through which we adapt to new and unwelcome realities. So if someone dies, grief is the process of reckoning with that, of feeling that, of having that become real to us in an emotional and spiritual way. And if you don't grieve, then you don't adapt to your new reality. You stay stuck between the past and the present. I think a lot of people know someone or have heard of someone who couldn't get over a loss. And a lot of couples, older couples die very soon after each other. It's just too devastating. Or just became stuck for years or for the rest of their life in a death of a partner or child, or, you know, these devastating losses can take people down in a way that they can't get out from. But grief is, I mean, it feels a little bit strange to say, because everyone knows grief is painful, but grief is actually the answer to these overwhelming losses. It is the mechanism through which we come to accept these horrible things. and adapt to them and find a new life given this reality. So
what about for you? Let's maybe talk about the things that you have grieved over the last couple of years as this realization's come about. I mean, children, becoming a mother, where are you at with that? Because the statistics in America and Australia are similar. Between a third to, I think, about 50% of millennials are saying they don't want to have children because of the climate crisis.
Yeah, it's a truly shocking thing, the amount of kind of dissonance, cognitive dissonance. We know that this is true in some areas, but then we forget it or, you know, deny it in others. But yeah, I'm not planning on having children because I would want to protect them and make sure that they could have a halfway decent life and chance. And it would just be, for me, a just torture to know that they were in so much danger. And, you know, even with all of my efforts, I couldn't ensure them what they deserve. So yeah, for me, that's a no. I absolutely had to grieve that.
How did you do the grief around that? Like, I'd love to know. Just it's a good example to work from to see the process, the psychological process.
Yeah, I mean, it's not rocket science. It's accepting your feelings, letting them be, crying, talking about the feelings with trusted people, you know, a therapist or a support group, but also just friends and family who are good listeners. And yeah, just giving it time, not fighting it. I mean, a lot of people have ideas about grief, such as, you know, it shouldn't go on for very long, or, you know, you should have it about this, but not this, you know, it was just my dog. I shouldn't feel grief, right? Like and so to not engage in that kind of judgment, but to accept that your grief is real and it matters, and that it reflects your love and connection.
Margaret, I'm wondering if you would find this interesting. There's a wonderful poet who I have done some work with, David White. He's written a lot about grief, and he describes grief as this falling through the floor. And you think you've fallen through a number of layers and surely that's enough. And then the bottom falls out again, and then it falls out again and again, and you keep falling through these floors. Eventually, and you don't know when, but you arrive at the landing spot. And what you realize is that landing spot is the space, the emotional, psychological space that thing you used to grieve would hold for you. And now you realize it's you that's there. It's you holding that space. So he saw grief as something that you have to fall through, like you fall into love. You fall in love, you fall in grief, until you land at the spot that the thing you grieved used to hold or take up. What do you reckon of that psychologically?
That, yeah, it's beautiful. It's very interesting. One part of that that I think is super important is the understanding that grief is a process and it does end. It ends, and then you still remember and honor what you lost or who you lost, but it takes on a different emotional quality. And so I think it's really important to realize that if you allow yourself to grieve, to fall through that floor, it doesn't go on forever. You don't just keep falling for the rest of your life, though it can feel that way, because you don't necessarily know when you're grieving that there is any end. But you have to go through it. You have to allow yourself to fall into it. If you try to avoid grief to get over it, then there you actually don't get to that floor. You don't find an end place to it.
So, Margaret, how have you used your grief and the facing of it and the landing there to activate yourself in such a way that your life has become meaningful in the climate movement? Because I think that's a really interesting process for people to understand, because that's your real pivotal thesis, that we can turn our pain into action. And in fact, the pain is sometimes the best precursor to getting us mobilized in that radical way.
Absolutely. It took me several years to move from a vague awareness and alarm about the climate emergency into action. And during those years, I learned more about the climate emergency. I grieved more. I felt tremendous anxiety and really terror. I mean, it felt like there was like a red light blasting in my face. And what changed everything for me was when my good friend said to me, "Don't start a blog," which is what I was planning, some kind of climate blog. I was a clinical psychologist. I would offer commentary, you know, like an academic kind of, that's just how the framework I was in. But my friend said, "Don't start a blog. Discourse isn't enough. Think, what could you do to actually solve this crisis?" That idea just blew my mind, that challenge. And I realized that I had never wanted anything more. But I had never let myself see it. I had never imagined myself as someone who could possibly change the world. It's just, I was outside of my self-concept. So, but what grief did and my terror did is it brought me, it created a huge well of motivation that when my friend said, "Well, try to stop it," right? "Try to not let the world collapse." It was like bursting through. So that happened in 2013. And since then, I've seriously been like a wild woman, just on this mission and doing things that I never thought I would do, like fundraise and, I mean, build websites, whatever it takes. It doesn't matter. I'll do anything. Yeah. So pain and fear are tremendous motivators. They're really the greatest motivators, right? I mean, we act in ways that make us feel good and not just, you know, happy on the surface, but feel whole and like we have meaning. And yeah, so if we feel all of that pain, it can absolutely motivate us to change our lives. And if we realize that the future we thought we had, the plans we thought we had, not going to happen.
There's two schools of thought though, isn't there, Margaret? And it's been, this first school of thought has dominated the environmental movement, as it was called. And that's this idea of, oh, let's go softly, softly. Let's talk about saving the koalas. Let's talk about preserving the planet. And it's been a lot of sugarcoating and avoidance, really. The language has been very avoidant. So I think there's been a shift now into this more emergency mode of thinking and discourse. And I think that's a really important one, the idea of that fear activates. But I get the impression, and this has been my experience, that if we talk just everyday fear, sort of CO2 tonnages and sea level rising and so on, it doesn't quite get people there. But when we go hardcore sort of reality checks and we get people facing those, whether it's at a barbecue and they have to put their sausages down or whatever it is, it can actually trigger what you went through, that sort of awakening. Can you talk me through, in your experience working with lots and lots of clients in this space, what are some real clangers, some real barbecue stoppers, some real hard facts about the climate that do tend to see a penny drop?
There's definitely statistics like 1.5 billion people are already water insecure, and that we could have a billion climate refugees by 2050. But honestly, I think that the climate discussion has been so intellectual, scientific, that I think speaking from the heart is the thing to do at a barbecue and almost all settings. So to say, like I said to you, and I was interested to read in your book that a lot of scientists confirm that they felt this way, that they thought that their cause of death would be the climate emergency, right? So say that, say, yeah, I don't. Mm. I mean, you can ask too, say, you know, what do you think the future holds? What do you see happening over the next 50 years? Because I can tell you what I see, and it ends in, you know, everybody here meeting a horrible fate.
What do you tell people when they say, okay, all right, well, what do you, Margaret, see? What, you know, tell me some of those realities that you have in your psyche at the moment.
I see the collapse of civilization driven by resource scarcity, water scarcity, food scarcity, as well as all of the other impacts of climate and all the other problems we're facing, wildfires, hurricanes, devastating whole regions. That were these disasters are getting so huge, like the bushfires in Australia, that I mean they're just on a different scale. So all of those things coming together, I don't think necessarily people know how fragile our systems are, and that, you know, food doesn't come from the grocery store. It comes through a complex chain of growing, distributing. And when that goes down, I mean, the UN talks about 12 meals that people or a region missing 12 meals, so four days without food, is enough to cause a tremendous social chaos, right? Because again, what do hungry people do? What would you do if there was no food and you didn't know how to get food?
That's right.
Right? I mean, and you didn't, and you were hungry and your family was hungry. I mean, people take drastic action. I would too. I don't know.
The other thing that's really frightening for people is when they start to realize, where people start to know now that the 1.5 degree increase above pre-industrialized levels is the threshold. Everybody sort of knows that now. When I point out to people, we are cruising for that way earlier than 2050. We're looking at it in the next 5 years. After that, life becomes uninhabitable. It becomes a different kind of life. It's not the life of being able to have summers at the beach and ski in the winter. All those things that we define as sort of wonderful aspects of our human existence, you know. When I point that out, it makes people go, oh.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think talking about the staggering rate of loss of animals, of insects, I think those are, I mean, it's horrifying. Over a billion, and I've seen estimates as high as 2 billion animals died in the Australian bushfires.
Yep, I've heard the same figures.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Transitioning to a decarbonized economy sounds like just one change. In fact, this shift requires several transitions across sectors, geographies, and timelines. In Talking Transitions, a new podcast brought to you by the EY organization and Foresight Climate and Energy, we look at how the transition is affecting three key areas: energy, financial services, and government. The Talking Transitions podcast is out now. Download today from wherever you get your podcasts or visit talkingtransitions.com to find out more.
I'm on board with you. I think putting the facts out there and getting people into a space of emergency mode is freeing, it's activating, and ultimately it's going to bring us meaning and engagement in a life that I think can be absolutely hopeful and wonderful. And I know that in your work with climate mobilisation, one thing that you've really worked alongside is this idea that World War II, you compare what happened in World War II, and America was incredible. Talk us through how that sort of metaphor of World War II can actually bring us a great deal of hope.
Yeah. The most hopeful I've ever felt about the climate emergency was from reading about World War II and what the United States and the Allies accomplished during that time, because after years of denial, right? It's not our war, you know, let it stay in Europe, America first. After years of that being the prevailing sentiment in the country and in Congress, after the surprise attacks on Pearl Harbor, isolationism evaporated overnight. Congress unanimously, minus one, voted to go to war. And I mean, we entered a different mode of functioning that I call emergency mode, in which it's an evolved way of being, in which when there is an understanding that we are threatened, we are existentially threatened, we will die, it kicks us into high gear, right? And we are able to cooperate and to sacrifice and to work towards the common good in just a totally different way. So, for example, during World War II, 40% of American vegetables were grown at home in victory gardens. And of course you would grow a victory garden, like, to support the war effort. That was totally normalized. 10% of Americans moved to a different state to work in a war job. Women started working in industrial occupations for the first time. And we converted our economy from a consumer economy to a war economy in just a few years. And that happened through a combination of spending, the government saying, of course we're going to spend everything we have on this, because otherwise, because the alternative, losing, is, you know, the same as death. It can, and also strong interventionist policy. None of this neoliberal hands off the market kind of thing. For example, we needed all of our car manufacturing capacity to make tanks and planes. So the government banned the sale of new automobiles, right? Like, sorry, can't do that. Got to do this other thing. And and on the individual level, the family level, meat, gasoline, tires, sugar, and other commodities were rationed. And every American got a fair share. The top tax rate on the highest earners was 94%.
That is mind-blowing. I mean, try to imagine that in today's culture. But look, Margaret, what was the thing that switched people's psychology? What was the clanger, the barbecue stopper thing that made people go, right, yeah, emergency? All the rules that we were living by before are redundant. We're going to have to adjust to the fact that life is vastly different now. What was the thing during World War II?
It was the attack on Pearl Harbor. And if you look at human evolution, human psychology, individual and group psychology as a product of evolution, it was perfect to achieve that trigger. We are evolved to have this us versus them mentality, and they attacked us and they surprised us, and so it's going to be harder this time, is the truth.
Okay, so yes, exactly. There's the element of immediacy and there's the element of an enemy out there. And as humans, we can rail against that. And that brings us into a collective framework. That tribalism kicks in and we rally together and we unify. And as you say, the climate crisis is absent of those two factors. We don't see the immediacy. And then the enemy is us, which is so psychologically unfathomable. What do you feel is going to ricochet us into action? What's going to fill that void?
I think it needs to be, this is, if we succeed in entering emergency mode and mobilizing to protect humanity in the living world, it will be, to my knowledge, the first time that humanity has been able to rally that kind of spirit outside of a violent war. Right?
Wow.
We don't, we're figuring it out as we go along, let's say. But I think what it's going to take is a consensus, a national and global consensus that our lives are in danger because of the climate emergency. And in some ways, it's like, holy shit, that's too much. That's never going to happen. And maybe so. But on the other hand, it's the truth. It's making itself more and more unavoidably obvious every day. And more people are waking up and doing things like changing their lives and devoting them to changing the system. So I think that that's also an important point. And I know you talk about this in your book, but I don't think the enemy is us. I think the enemy is the system.
Yes.
And it is true. What is the system? Well, it's us and it's what we do, right? But it's so much bigger than us. And I think orienting around that is really important, and understanding the best way for you to try and protect yourself and your family and the whole human family is to try to change the system, is to do what you can to change the system. That is going to have more impact, more power than changes you can make in your own life. And I think it's a more exciting way of just living and viewing yourself. You're not a consumer. You're a citizen. You're a change agent.
One thing I wanted to pick up on is you do a bunch of activities and one-on-one, no doubt over the phone now instead of groups, no doubt on Zoom, but you work with clients doing these turning pain into action type psychological processes. Is it something that you can do with me now, or, you know, like, is it something that we can do together, or do you want to just talk through it? Because I'd really love to leave people with a process that they can work with after they listen to this.
Yeah, so it's really simple, actually. I mean, how do you feel about the climate emergency? Creating space for people to talk about that. Yes. So tell me more. Tell me more about how you feel.
Yeah. Well, I feel really scared. I get overwhelmed with a really big, expansive emotion, which I can't say I've experienced in any other format, mostly around my nieces and nephews. the life that we've left them with. I find myself crying in this frustrated sense of, how did we get to this? You know, I feel cringy that I am, you know, I benefited from the very things that have made the future for my nieces and nephews impossible. So, yeah, and I am scared. I'm scared when I think about when everybody realizes what's going on, the incredible pain and sadness that humanity is going to feel. I can feel that already.
Well, thank you so much for sharing. And I think it's, I think it's actually terrific just because it's always impactful to hear people's stories, right? I feel moved. I feel, because we're all dealing with this horrible situation. And really, for people, emotions and our perceived realities, our lived realities, it's actually more real for people. It touches them more than science, statistics, intellect, right? So by asking people, by creating a space that asks people, how do you feel about the climate emergency? And having them share those feelings like you just did with each other. It's so simple, but it freaking works.
So what happens next? What do you say next, you know, when I sort of talk about that? And I might rebut you and go, but why will my emotions change anything? Nobody seems to be doing anything and I don't know where to start. How do I make that transferal into activation, mobilization?
After you have experienced the fear, grief, terror, rage, guilt, shame, after you, let's say, have allowed yourself to experience those feelings, which were there anyway, but after naming them and looking at them squarely and hearing other people share their feelings, right? Then is the time to ask, okay, so, you know, so what? So what about it? What am I going to do? What can I do? That is kind of the question that anyone who talks about climate will get over and over and over again. But it's not like, oh, boom, here's the answer, right? Like, number one, talk about the climate emergency and do it emotionally. That's the one thing that I tell everyone to do because it makes it real. It breaks the silence. But that's just a starting place. And the next thing, to find your unique place in the climate emergency movement, that is as complicated and personal as choosing a career, right? Like, what is the unique and important way that you can contribute to this transformation? And so in my book, Facing the Climate Emergency, the final chapter tries to help people really think through this rigorously, like, you know, starting from how many hours can I commit to this a week?
Yes.
Can I commit money to this and how much? Am I willing to get arrested? What's my risk tolerance? Do I have special skills like graphic design or bookkeeping that an organization can use? Like, what you need to do is take all that motivation and try to find the most effective route to change the system that you can. And that's almost certainly going to be through joining or supporting an organization, other people, right? That's how we get stuff done, is through coordinated efforts, not really like, you know, solo stuff in the vast majority of cases.
Yeah, yeah. And I think one thing I really think is really important, and you've triggered this in me, is that I think the process of talking about it psychologically and acknowledging the shared pain and grief and fear and terror is that the answer as to what you do next comes through that. You've got to be enrolled and you've got to actually put the work in, like you say, finding a career and going for it, not just thinking it's going to come magically. But I think that the process of getting over that psychological blockage, this idea that I just want to curl up in a ball and pretend it's not happening, is just so incredibly important. And like with World War II, we need to see everybody else doing it. And that is motivating, you know? It needs to become a kamikaze kind of fast-moving train, and we all get on board, and it goes places. And I think I want to sort of finish off with the fact that I do find all of this really terrifying, and especially going back to that idea of the mass civil unrest, that probably stops people more than anything, because it's an ugly aspect of humanity. I mean, if we're going to die, I don't want to see humans dying in such a low way, a low, unevolved way where we're fighting each other. So it is the scariest bit, but what I've found is that by activating, and I'd love to get your comment on this, by activating, doing everything I can, it almost drowns out all of that paralyzing fear. I fill that space that used to be filled with fear, paralyzing fear. I feel it now with the very thing that I'm scared might be taken from us, and that is our humanity. Because while I'm activating, I'm engaged with the best of humanity. And I wanted to see if that's what goes on for you, Margaret, with the work you're doing now, because you've been in this space now for almost 10 years. Is that how you feel? Does that resonate?
I feel in a very deep and integrated way, like nothing else matters. And that has given me a clarity. I mean, and it's the grief too, that I went through a process of grief. I grieved the future that I thought I had. And now this is what I have. I have this fight. And is that what I would choose? No. But I'm honored to be in it. I'm proud of what I've contributed, and I am more happy about who I am than I'd ever been before in my life. It doesn't feel good to live in this whatever Western consumer capitalist notion of the self, right? Just like, you know, building my resume, or, you know, building your brand or whatever. It's like, I was super focused on that and kind of insecure. And like, it feels so much better to care about something more than you care about yourself, and to view yourself as an instrument of change. So I just have allowed myself to kind of merge with the mission, in a way that I would never go back to normal life. It's actually much more fulfilling to live in truth and to have peace with yourself, as it sounds like you do, that like, what is the answer to this horrible situation and all of this grief and pain? Well, it's to go all out to try and prevent it.
Full stop. Amen. So Margaret and I covered a few gargantuan and gnarly truths here, and I hope you're all coping off the back of it. We will very likely die of the climate crisis, and it will horribly likely be via the mass civil unrest that will arise out of food and water shortages, and it's not going to be from inundation or heat exhaustion. But also, denial is exhausting. And we are all damn exhausted. I am. I'm guessing that you are too. Plus, frankly, truth feels good. Like me, you might have been left after this conversation asking, please, as substantially as possible, please tell me again, how can I turn this unfathomable pain I'm feeling into action and joy and peace and a life of meaning? Margaret's action point, and it's a very sound one, is to do the grief and to do it together. So I guess the suggestion that we can all take away here is get together, form a Zoom group, talk about what you're feeling, name it as grief. And this simple process gets rid of the exhausting denial, and that's huge. It also then leaves you with the energy and the psychic space to start doing stuff that can shift the dial. I'll add to Margaret's thoughts, actually, that the prefrontal cortex shuts down, like you go numb when it's overwhelmed with fear or exhausting denial. It's a survival mechanism. So if you flesh out your grief, you keep things open and working and you can stay active. At the same time, the mere action of just forming a Zoom group and fleshing things out around grief a bit further with your friends drowns out the fear. If you think this sounds too simple, it's actually totally what I've done, and I have found that it works over the last couple of years. I started by voicing up and learning and facing my fear, and I started to feel better. So I did more and more until I landed here with you chatting on this podcast. As James Baldwin wrote in the 1960s amid incredible racial upheaval, not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it is faced. If you're after a starting point, I run regular Instagram lives to chat through these kinds of big emotions. I do it semi-regularly. I also have a book club guide you can work to for piecing through climate pain, which you can get off my website. And Margaret has a really good Let's Talk About the Climate Emergency project that she runs via www.climateawakening.org. And you can join a group of about 2 to 5 people, and there are conversation prompts from Margaret. You might find that helpful. And there's also this, which gets me excited and also emotional and very activated. If we shift the world into this emergency mode and mobilize like these magical unicorn mofos, it will be the first time we've ever done it outside a war. I'm not sure about you, but this idea sings to me. Mobilizing around that makes me feel that I will have at least done something truly special and meaningful with my one wild and precious life. So let's all go out, get kamikaze with it, merge with our mission, and arrive at our meaning together.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Transitioning to a decarbonized economy sounds like just one change. In fact, this shift requires several transitions across sectors, geographies, and timelines. In Talking Transitions, a new podcast brought to you by the EY organization and Foresight Climate and Energy, we look at how the transition is affecting three key areas: energy, financial services, and government. The Talking Transitions podcast is out now. Download today from wherever you get your podcasts or visit talkingtransitions.com to find out more.